Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out so early in the morning on a gray day, but we've made it. This is our last lecture. Hooray. I've made it through my six almost, and I'm very grateful to be able to speak with you all. This has been a great pleasure for me. What I want to talk about today is, again, if my my whole plan with this series of talks is try and make more complicated what I've talked of as that simple idea of what the American movie audience was like, the American media audience was like, instead of just saying one, to discover many kinds of difference and the importance of sort of local case studies, looking at a few people in a certain time and a certain place. And of course, in American culture, to speak of just something American ideas overlooks the tremendous racial problems America had all through the 19th and 20th century and still has today, about the idea of racial difference in the United States, speaking of African Americans. And so I'm sort of pleased. It's been important to me in this project I have been writing, my book about that comedian Jack Benny, who I was talking about yesterday, who I will continue to talk about today. I'm very glad to have the opportunity in my research project to write about the differences and problems and challenges that African-American actors faced in American film and American radio, and the difficulties of sort of understanding between white audiences and black audiences, the difficulty of creating a black character that would be pleasing to all audiences and not insulting. As I said, my talk today investigates the difficulties this man, this actor named Eddie Anderson, had creating the character on the radio of Rochester. That character, Rochester, was the only major black character in American media in the 1930s and 40s. He was the most major. He was the most highly paid, but it was, and he was very popular with white audiences and very popular with black audiences. But I'm going to be talking about the difficulties he faced, because there were racist whites who said, "Oh, this is terrible." There were blacks who said, "Oh, this is terrible. He is an Uncle Tom. He is betraying. He is kowtowing to whites too much. He is terrible." So this poor man, who was a wonderful actor, faced, as I said, the problems of pleasing, of earning his income, of working, of being very beholden to Jack Benny, of trying to be famous, of trying to be have white audiences like him, trying to have black audiences like him. It was a whole, I've learned, it was a whole a ball of problems and challenges as this man had to try and negotiate. So that's what I'm going to try and talk about today. To begin with, I think it's useful to remember that African Americans, that blacks were caricatured tremendously in American media. American blacks made up perhaps 10% of American population. A little history, the Africans were brought over, maybe only 400,000 of them were brought over to America as slaves in the 1600s and 1700s. But now, meanwhile, 400,000 to the American colonies, to the United States, 4 million to the Caribbean, to Jamaica and Central and South America, 4 million. Many more of these 4 million died because of disease and the terrible working conditions in the Jamaican sugar farms, things like that. Ironically, of the 400,000 that came to the American colonies as slaves, relatively few of them died. The lack of disease in the open, wide spaces of the U.S. and the fact, the bizarre fact that American slave masters needed their labor and found it useful to feed and care for their slaves meant that the black population, the African population, continued and grew between 1600. To the American Civil War, there were about 4 million. So from 400,000 to 4 million. At the time of the American Civil War, The Northern armies used tried to get African Americans to flee from slavery, and more than 100,000 African American soldiers, former slaves, served as soldiers in the Union Army, and that made some terrible racism as black soldiers with guns are facing Confederate Southern soldiers with guns. So I want you, after the Civil War, freed 4 million African Americans. The problem was all the 4 million African Americans in the South were given their freedom, but they were left down in the South where with the very prejudiced Southerners. And the whites did not like them at all. And the white Southerners, enacted many laws, many social customs, many ways of keeping that black population down. It was very difficult to get an education. It was impossible for a black man to get a good job in the South. The black women could only work as servants, scrubbing and serving as maids in white people's houses. So I want you to think from 1860, this would be about 75 years later, into the 1930s, the majority, maybe 75% of those still 4 to 5 million blacks still lived in the South. They were very poor. They worked as farmers on the land, but they did not own the land because they had no money. They worked for white landowners who charged them great rents and things like that, and said, and when they didn't have the money to pay the rent, it became indentured servitude. It will be, well, then you, your whole family will continue to farm for so many years to try and pay off the debt you owe me. And the debts and debts and debts will go very higher. So I want you to think conditions were very, very poor for African Americans in the South. Now, with the coming of factories in the American North and Midwest, in Detroit, in Chicago, in cities and business in cities like Harlem in New York City, there were opportunities. And in the 20th century, more and more rural blacks, farmers in the South, started to move to the North to take factory jobs. And they hoped to come to a land, a place with less prejudice, less racism, less hatred. It was not true. When they got to the North, the racism followed them. White Northerners did not like blacks any more than Southerners. There were not laws segregating people, but there were often customs that said blacks in the North must live in this ghetto. Blacks in the North must only hold the lowest jobs. Nevertheless, there was still among the blacks a hope that maybe things could get better. Maybe so. Facing tremendous odds, there was nevertheless still a hope among African Americans that things would get better. This would lead to during World War II, during the Second World War, when the American government needed blacks to go fight against the German, to fight for freedom, to fight all over the world to stop the Japanese and stop the Germans. African Americans, black Americans, were very quizzical about this. And they're saying, you want me to fight for America, but why should I fight for a country that treats me so badly? Why fight for a country where I'm not even a second class, but a third class citizen? And so President Roosevelt and the American government tried to make promises to the black people, tried to say, we enact laws to stop the racism, to say you will get an equal chance at war, at jobs in war factories, that you will get paid equally. Still, the American military was still segregated. Blacks could not serve with whites in the military. They were separate units. But as I said, there was this push, at least from the administrators on top, to say, yes, things will get better. Yes, please do work for us. Things will get better. Now, to finish the rest of that story, after the end of the war, when blacks come back, having fought very valiantly in all over the world, in World War II, they come back to the American South. They come back to Chicago and Harlem and Detroit to find that racism is worse than ever. But now, increasingly, and during World War II and after World War II, the younger generation of blacks who had fought, who had maybe had more education, some had even gone to college in black colleges, they're going, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. This is the beginning of the civil rights movement, where on the one hand, labor leaders like A. Philip Randolph said, we're going to strike, we're going to demand equal wages. Ministers like Martin Luther King Jr. said he's going to use nonviolent protests the way Gandhi had been doing in India. So he says, across the South, we are going to act so polite. We're going to show how right it is that what we just want is equality, that we will convince America of how right we are. We will use, we will love our enemies, and we will use that, that kind of civilian quiet protest to try and change things. So at the end of the war, all through the 1950s, is percolating both in the American South and up in the American North, more militants, as in, we're not going to take this anymore. We demand our rights to be equal. And whether you did it politely or whether you did it through fighting, there was, as I said, this urge. It would come to, I'm teaching a course to my students in Texas on the 1960s in America. And in the 1960s, this fight for equality of African Americans reached yet another new generation. The young college students born in 1945, who become college students in the 1960s, say this is still taking too long. We want freedom now. We want civil rights now. And so it is that next generation in the 1960s that do things like have the sit-ins at lunch counters, that go and sit in at the restaurant and say, I will not leave. You will serve me. You will take my money. I will be equal in consumer culture. You will sell me things. I will be able to buy things. And we will sit here at the counter until you serve us and treat us as equal. When they would sit very politely in their best suits and dresses and reading their college textbooks, waiting for just a cup of coffee or a glass of water, ignorant whites, thugs would come and beat at them, and then American police would haul them off to jail. And it became a badge of honor to have been into jail to fight for American civil rights. So they said this percolated up. So the longtime longings of 100 years from 1860 and the Civil War to 1960 and civil rights, it through that decade of fighting, of rioting, of being nonviolent protest, of finally getting the American government to pass laws at the very top, outlawing unequal treatment in the workplace, in stores, in finding housing, in voting, most importantly, in voting, finally brought things much more equal for African Americans in society. So if part of that ongoing process, my fellow, he's sort of part of that process. He is both doing quite well. He's famous. He's earning lots of money. He's the one very prominent character. But he gets this way by being very compromising to the white people. Oh, yes. And he enacts the role of a servant. You know, here, sir, have some water. Yes, I will scrub your floors. And that position both made him acceptable to white audiences. Of course he's a servant. Oh, of course he's a jokester, he's a trickster. Oh, of course he's this lower guy. So the character was acceptable to a wide range of Americans, but not to the worst racists. The worst racists in the South that go, oh, we don't want to see a black man. This is terrible. No black man should be on a show. No black, you know, they were so bad about it. They wanted blacks down permanently. So Eddie would face that problem from those who wanted him down permanently. He appealed to the wide variety of Americans who could accept him in the servant role of scrubbing. To the black audiences, to the most of them, they were so happy to finally see a black actor doing well. And he's very funny, and he speaks back to his boss. And so for the most black audiences, they were very happy. They were very proud to have him doing well. But to the young generation, especially those fighting in World War II, they said, oh, this is terrible. He's scrubbing for the white man. He's bowing down to the white man. This is terrible. We get rid of him. So, as I said, Eddie is going to face all these problems. Well, as I said, in American media, for black audiences and white audiences, a representation of black characters was very bad throughout the media. You have all seen and heard about The Birth of a Nation, absolutely terrible. Lies about terrible representation about what black folks would like. To racist whites, the only good blacks were those who were happy servants, scrubbing, bowing, bending, yes sir, yes ma'am, yes boss. As they said, the most prejudiced whites would accept only those black characters. And yet that comes out in American media. I spoke to you yesterday about the most prominent program in early radio being a story about those kind of blacks written by two white men. So not even black themselves, but white men writing the story of these two happy, kind of stupid guys who get into fun. You know, they're very, on the one hand, very funny and very terrific stories. But the problem was they were the only representations of blacks anywhere in the popular culture. And the black audiences said, oh, can't we have anything else? Why only one? And why not written by us? Why just happy and stupid and getting taken advantage of and things like that? Here was the problem of it was smart, but it was stupid. It was not, it was the only characterization of blacks in the mass media, but it was done by whites. Okay, so really frustrating. Now over in film, the situation was also very bad. The terrible character, this actor, Stepan Fetchit, played especially bad roles. He played what the black community would call it an Uncle Tom role, coming from the 19th century story of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Uncle Tom was an old slave servant, loved his white master. Yes, master. Yes, master. I'm so happy. I will scrub for you. Beat me. That's okay. I love you like a pet dog. Oh, you know. So. That was an image that was comforting to whites. It's easy, but the black audience, really terrible. Well, this actor was one of the ones most often used in Hollywood films of the 20s and 1930s. Here he is with Will Rogers. Remember, the small town audiences liked Will Rogers. But here, Stepan Fetchit played a very stupid man, very stupid, a bad accent. You can see him leaning over, and this is just, it's very painful for us to watch today. You go, oh, terrible. But in the 1930s, again, that character reassured whites that, oh, blacks are not going to compete with us for jobs. Blacks are not going to university. Blacks are not smart. It's okay to think of them down in the South as being, mired in poverty, and that the good black will be stupid and will be cowering and will do whatever the master wants. So, interestingly, biographies have come out of this man. I can't remember his real name, but Stepan Fetchit, off screen, supposedly was a very intelligent, bright man, and he claimed that he did, that this was all an act, that he understood he was playing a terrible character. But he didn't feel guilty about it. But he said, I need to eat. Someone, if it wasn't me, they would hire some other actor to portray this kind of a job. And so, as they said, biographies of this man said, offstage, he's kind, he's smart, he's nice. He took the money from Hollywood studios. He had a nice car, a lovely house, all these things. But as I said, the black community is very frustrated with this role that is so unlike real life, that was very damaging to them. I'm saying, for every when all you see, when you see no other characters other than this very stupid one, white audiences and those who have no contact with actual blacks, and in the North, the few blacks that lived up there were kept very separate in ghettos, so they did not go to school with white children. You did not grow up. They were kept very separate. And so most white audiences didn't know an African-American to shake his hand. But if you don't know and all you see are these things in the media, you get the idea planted in your head that they're stupid or dumb or, you know. So that's the danger of these stereotypes in mass media. So as I said, this is a very prevalent, the very few roles in Hollywood films would often be like that. For the men, for the women, there were two ways of having roles for black women. One is, this is Hattie McDaniel. One is the good old mammy. She's very fat. She's very nice. She's hardworking. She will love the little white babies. She will love the white family. She maybe has no family of her own. Her whole life is giving to the white family. And she's jolly and she has no sexuality. And as I said, she just lives happy, working, loving the little white families and the little white children and all this. She, again, very comforting to whites. Oh, she won't cause trouble. She's very loyal. We can give her very little. She will be very happy. To black audiences, again, very frustrating. While there were women who had to, this was one of the few jobs black women could get. If no factory will hire you, if no business will hire you, the one job, and more black women could get work than black men, you could scrub for the white people. You could be somebody's servant. And there are many stories of mothers working very hard all their lives to scrub to send their children to college. So, as I said, the role itself is could be very strong, could be very independent. That's not how it was shown in American film. So the black audience was very ambivalent about these roles for the mammies. They said, how come you never hear about her family at home? How come she never stands up for herself? Why is she so jolly and scrubbing for the white folks? So they said, the only other role for black women would be that of kind of the prostitute, the whore, the lascivious, open, jiggly, party kind of girl, you know, very sexually available. And that was very attractive to white men. In the same way that when everybody was slaves, the white men in the South raped black women, slept with all their black slaves, and produced many mixed-race children who would all then be consumed, even though they may look just like the little white children the same slave owner had, the little black children or the little mixed-race children would be considered slaves. So, like I said, I want you to think, so very bad news all around. The stereotypes were very hurtful to the black community, but very comforting to the white community as they explained why blacks would never get any better in American society, why they indeed deserved to stay down here at the lowest level. So very frustrating. And for black actors, I said very, very frustrating, because these are the only roles you can get. If you won't take those roles, you will starve, because there are no other roles. Well, that is the world. That is the world Eddie Anderson grew up in. It's very interesting. I'm happy. I'm proud to have done the first research on his history, because there are of the academic works of scholars doing biographies. There's a very good new biography of Hattie McDaniel. There's some books about Step and Fetch It. There are books about Paul Robeson, other actors, Lena Horne, Louis Armstrong, other Duke Ellington. So there have been research about prominent black performers, but nobody's ever paid attention to Eddie. And I'm very happy to be the first to do the research to build up his role and talk about how important he was. I think the scholars have forgotten about Eddie, one, because he's in radio, not film, but radio, and Americans have forgotten about radio. It was all done live. It went off into the ether. It was commercial. I'm very lucky that for the Jack Benny's shows were all recorded, and I have almost all of them, and I can listen to them, and I'm trying to recreate that history. So I have documents. It turns out Eddie himself left no record. He was a very quiet, shy man, and he always felt caught between these two extremes of racist whites who would hate him and liberal blacks who would say, "You're doing terrible things." So he would never speak to reporters. He would not give interviews. He did not want to take a position and stand up, because if he stood up for civil rights, he would lose his job. And he didn't want to stand up and say, "I like scrubbing white floors." He didn't want to. So he said nothing. And by saying nothing, he's fallen out of the historical record, and the historians have had nothing to go by. So I was pleased to do a lot of research and try and find out things. And so I want to tell you just a little bit about his story, because it illuminates that of many other black performers on the lower level striving to do better, and how difficult it was to try and do something. So Eddie Anderson was actually born in San Francisco, California, in 1905. So his family had escaped the rural South. His grandparents had been slaves. But at the end of the Civil War, supposedly one set of grandparents had been stolen by the abolitionists and freed and taken to Kansas, to the Middle West. So stolen and taken to the Middle West for freedom. his father's family had, again, also been able to move from the slave South up to the state of Michigan. So both his parents were born in freedom just at the end of the Civil War, and both of them became entertainers. That's one of the few ways you could make a living in black culture if the jobs are very, very poor anywhere else. If you have acting talent, why not become an entertainer? Eddie's father was a minstrel. After the Civil War, more and more minstrels actually were black. Now, the minstrel performance, a very American tradition, but very mixed up and odd about race, because it was started by white men, and minstrel shows were much like Amos and Andy. It was white men blacking up their faces and coming out live on stage and singing and dancing and acting very stupid and telling dumb jokes, but singing and dancing and doing all manner. It became American popular entertainment. It was the first American popular entertainment form in the 19th century. Everybody had minstrel shows. Everybody loved them. It was whole communities put them together because it was, they said, a lot of singing, a lot of dancing, but again, lots of stereotypes about what these cartoon images of what blacked up people would be. Okay, so come in the latter part of the 19th and into the 20th century, minstrel shows were still popular, but now they were being done by black actors who still put the even blacker makeup on their faces. And they performed the ritual of coming out and dancing and singing and being stupid. But again, it was a way to make a living. It was a performance. So I said, his father was one of those minstrels. His mother was a tightrope walker. So she was in the circus. She was an act, but she eventually fell and broke her back. So the four children, all the children, had to go out and find work to help the family get along. From when he was a little boy, he used to sell newspapers. Get your paper here! Da, 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 da. And he did it so much that he ruined his voice. We will hear. So Eddie's most famous characteristic, he's a croaky, kind of a croaky little voice like that. Mine is sounding like this today. I'm becoming Eddie Anderson. So his most distinctive characteristic was his amazing voice. But he was also a dancer. So he was known as a dancer who did little comic routines. But he had the characteristic of his voice. He spent, from growing up on the West Coast, he spent his early childhood, as I said, little odd jobs. Very soon he turned to performing. It's a way to make a living. He was quite the tap dancer. Hey, you should see me tap dance. He and his brothers danced together, and so he spent many years out there, again, fighting prejudice, but you could, I mean, his options were limited, but he could dance in shows for white folks, or he danced in clubs. There was a small black community in Los Angeles, in Watts, on Central Avenue. There was a black entertainment community, and he performed there often. That was his home. There was a lot of prejudice on the West Coast, too, against blacks, and blacks all had to live in the same ghetto. But in the ghetto, there were theaters and bars and clubs that whites would come into and pay for their liquor and expect to be entertained. And so there were jobs. Eddie started performing with, he would dance and sing, but he would be with young bands that were growing up like Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington. So he was with really marvelous musicians as jazz is growing. So he's mixed up, and he's in this entertainment world on a rather low level, but he's fighting to have a little career. He and his brother got involved in a company that was going to tour the U.S., all black performers, maybe 50 of them, putting on a kind of show. And the company was going on, and it got broke. It disappeared in the middle of America, in Omaha, Nebraska, in about 1925. And here, they're thousands of miles away from home. What to do? Luckily, the theater manager liked young Eddie and his brother, dancers, and got them jobs at movie theaters in the Midwest. So Eddie did have experience for about 4 years in the middle of America, traveling with entertainment groups, dancing, singing, so making a good career for himself, but never able to get much higher, but okay, working very, very hard, singing, dancing. He gets back out to Hollywood, and about back to the West Coast, where his family lives, and they've moved down to Los Angeles. So he's back to Hollywood in about 1930. And again, he's scraping together. He's getting jobs at clubs for Hollywood executives. This is where the Hollywood movie stars and people who work in the movie industry come at night in their elegant outfits to see the black performers dance and sing. And so he's doing quite well with that, but it's still kind of limited. He works every single night. And he's earning an all right little income, but again, that's about the best he's going to be able to do. In the 1930s, especially with the coming of talkies, Hollywood movies have a few roles for African Americans, and he played many roles without getting any credit. Very tiny roles, walk on, he would play a waiter, he would play a chauffeur, open, driving the car. He played, I have dozens and dozens of tiny little roles that didn't even get screen credit. He would pay like $10 for the day. Would be one day of work. But he was he really wanted to pursue his entertainment career. So he was willing to fight to get the one day's job for $10, playing a chauffeur, playing a butler, playing a servant, scrubbing. Meanwhile, then at night, he'd be at the club dancing and singing. So I just want you to think he worked very, very hard, but it didn't look, and he was having to piece together all manner of little performances. Indeed, it's not like it's the same way that Jack Benny started his career, playing the violin, piecing together little jobs. So I like to think that there are some parallels between their two experiences. This picture is one of the earliest I found of him. This picture to me makes him look like, very much like, Stephen Fetchit. This is, to try and get a job in Hollywood, he had to try and model himself on the few things that Hollywood want. If these were the only jobs out there and he wanted to eat, if Eddie wanted a job in Hollywood, he would have to be like this. And ergo, as I said, he had pictures of himself made to send to the studios going, if you need a stupid black character, hire me. So it's very kind of sad, okay? But that's the best he's trying to do. Well, so he's been doing that in 1937. He is about 32 years old. Up comes a one-time opportunity. The radio industry that had all been in New York is starting to move to California, where the films are made. Jack Benny was one of the very first big performers to relocate out to Los Angeles. Previous to that, all the radio was in New York. If black actors had very few roles, but a few in film, there were almost no roles in radio. If blacks were hoping for opportunities here, they thought they had no opportunities over in radio. Because in radio, very few characters were black, and when you needed one small character, radio did not hire a black actor for a small role, because they didn't need to see him. Radio would use a white man. They would use a voice actor who could do a dozen different accents, who could do German, who could do Italian, who could do Polish, who could do Russian, who could do black dialect. Radio, because it's through the ears, when they want, radio producers enjoyed ethnic dialogue. They loved a funny accent. They thought funny accents were very, very amusing. But it's also, they needed clearly, distinctly different characters. If they had had four characters in front of a radio mic all talking together, and if they all sounded alike, the listeners couldn't tell them apart. So, as I said, radio, especially in the 1930s and 1940s, would bring in someone who speaks with a very German accent. But speaks to someone who is, parlez-vous français, oh good, a French accent. So, and for African Americans, they didn't want, hello, I speak like a normal American. What they wanted from black actors was, yes, boss, I'm just doing fine. Nah, nah, nah. So they said the radio producers wanted that to seem distinct, but it's very, of course, very limited of what they wanted because the roles were very few. They could just go ahead and use white men to play the black roles. So I want you to think, if you're a black actor and you want jobs and you're looking for a way to make a living in the business, your options are very few. If you're in film, you have to play stupid. And there's no roles at all in radio. So that's the world Eddie Anderson is in. In 1937, as I said, Jack Benny has moved out to Los Angeles. Benny's radio show has been on the air for 5 years. And he, too, his writers have enjoyed using the ethnic characterizations they have. He has a Jewish man named Schlepperman on the air who is a sly trickster, a very funny man who gives out with the Yiddish. Single roles, one-time kind of things of German, of Irish, of Scotch. They love Scotch because they're so cheap, they have nothing in their pockets, of Italians, of things like that, and the very occasionally black roles. Well, in 1937, Jack's writers have come up, Jack and they need a story. And they have a story that Jack has been needs to travel from New York back out to his home in California. He's been in New York doing a show. And he's on the train, and the train takes like 3 days to cross America. We're a big country. And a tradition in the show, as it's coming along, is that Jack, the character of Jack Benny, is a foolish old man. He's very cheap. He will not spend a penny on anything. He's always trying to get out of spending any kind of money. But also, the character, Jack, always meets people who are nasty to him, who frustrate him, make him get angry. So he never meets nice people who get along. He always meets unusual characters who frustrate him and get him nervous and things like that. So the writers, while he's on this train from New York to Los Angeles, want to come up with a character just for one show that will annoy Jack on the train. And they thought, shall it be the conductor, the engineer of the train? Shall it be a passenger on the train? They thought, how about we have the porter on the train, the fellow who has the luggage, who serves in the restaurant on the train, who makes the beds up. They said, well, we'll get a porter, but we only need it for one show. And Jack said, well, if it's only for one show, let's use white actors. Let's use one of our voice actors. That will do. It's only for one time. They can, I can do it. They can do that. Fine. But the writers said, oh, no, we broadcast. We do the radio performance in front of a live audience. And if we use a white actor for this role, going, yes, sir, the audience will be very confused. They will say, Jack says, oh, we'll just black him up. And the writers are going, no, no, no. Can't we, for this one role, hire an actual black person? So, indeed, the cast they have, but they only have like 4 days to find someone for this weekly show for the one role. So, Jack and his writers put out an ad. They interview a number of people. While Eddie was not the very best, Jack was very intrigued by his voice. Rochester's voice was very interesting. It was interesting to the ear, and Jack liked accents that were interesting to the ear. So he hired him for this one-time role. And the way that the character annoys Jack is that Jack's on the train there in New Mexico. He's asking, are we going to stop at Albuquerque, New Mexico? And Rochester just goes, Albuquerque? I never heard of no Albuquerque. And Jack says, look here, it's in the schedule. We're stopping in Albuquerque. And the train porter, just playing with him, goes, oh, no, there's no Albuquerque. This show was very funny. I'm not making it very funny, but believe me, the way it was produced and acted, it was very, very funny. And even though he was only on for this one-time part, many people wrote in. There was a lot of fan mail, and people going, yeah, that was really great. Yeah, that was really super. And Jack and his authors sort of thought about that, and they loved his voice. They loved that voice. And so, over the next several months, They brought him back for another one time, and a few months later for another one time. Anonymous roles. A waiter here, a guy on the street there. But as they said, they loved Aunt Rochester's voice. So finally, in December, 5 months later, they create a new permanent character on the show. And they name him, and they bring Eddie back, they hire Eddie, and they name him Rochester. How am I doing? So they name it. So the new permanent character on the show named Rochester. Well, he became very famous, very popular, and I want to talk about the problems of working him into the show. The writers chose and not to remember. I said that Jack Benny's show is about a group of performers here who their job on the show is to put on a radio show. So all the rest of the performers have regular radio functions. This is Don Wilson. He's that fat announcer who likes Jell-O. So his real job is to announce, hello, this is the Jack Benny program. So that's Don's role. Phil Harris's role, he leads the band. He's also very stupid and always drunk. But his job is to lead the band for the radio show. Dennis's role is the singer. He's very young. And he's rather stupid, but his girl, he sings the show. He sings a couple songs on every show. He does the sound effects. There's Jack. Mary, who is Jack's wife off stage, on stage has the most unusual role for any woman in radio because she's on the radio show, but she has no real role. She is not Jack's girlfriend. They're not in love. They're not a couple. She's kind of the secretary for Jack Benny, but she is not leading the band, she's not singing, she's not reading the announcements, but she kind of hangs around. And this allows her, in the show, she's the one who, every time Jack does something stupid, she's the one who calls him on it. Jack, you're stupid. Jack, that's wrong. It's marvelous. No other woman. Women in the 1930s were supposed to be sweet, supposed to be kind, supposed to be quiet, supposed to, you know. And here she is going, no, you're wrong. Ah, she loved to laugh. So they said she's an unusual character, but she's on the radio show just to be Jack's friend, but to also poke fun at him. So when they bring Rochester, Eddie Anderson, into the show, the writers and Jack make this decision that they have his character not be a part of the regular radio show. His role is to be Jack's servant at home. Rochester is supposed to scrub and cook and be Jack's butler and take care of his suits and all this. And so he's supposed to be very separate from the radio show. So the show struggles in 1938 with how do we work him into the show? Because they're here doing things at the radio show and sometimes they have to telephone the Rochester character who's at home. And have him read his, and have it, so, again, they try very hard to keep him separate. But this means, eventually, in the show, they have more and more stories that happen over at Jack's house. The whole gang comes over to Jack's house so that they can interact. Or there will be many more scenes of Jack and Rochester at home as Rochester cooks for him, cleans for him, as they interact. This part is really interesting because this part has not happened in American film or radio. This is a white man and a black man just interacting all the time, being a sort of comedy duo. I will talk about a little, they are one master and servant, but in many ways they are very equals. And that is very new and different in society. But nevertheless, when they first come on the air when he's first on the show in 1938, he needs a drink of water. And then spills it all over his floor. When he's first on the show in 1938, and they're wondering what to do, it's very interesting to read the scripts and hear the dialogue, because in the earliest shows, Rochester is a very bad character. He is very much like Stephen Fetchett. What he does on those earliest shows is he steals. He breaks things. He's a very bad servant. He lies. He cheats. All kinds of things that make the white audience go, ah, ha, ha, ha. Of course, Rochester is a lower kind of individual. On the other hand, very quickly, Rochester's language starts becoming more and more sophisticated. it turned very quickly. They changed. So this business of him lying, cheating, stealing, being very low, only lasts a few months. The writers realize that that's prejudice, but it's also not very funny. There's not much to do with it. So the Rochester character begins to get smarter and smarter. Although he's still at home, the servant, he gets wiser and wiser, and that makes him a lot more fun. He goes from lying and cheating and stealing to, as I said, his language. Although it's spoken in that kind of accent, it's very smart words. The other thing is that the Rochester character at home, much like the Mary character, also gets to criticize him. But he gets to criticize him as the servant. Oh, and he calls Jack boss. Now, boss harkens back to days of slavery, but at least boss is a very informal kind of direct. He could have had to say Mr. Benny or Master. But so he's never having to say Master Benny. He gets to call him boss. Boss is more informal, but it still harkens back to slavery days and what workers, bunches of slave workers, would have to call their manager, the white man, boss. But the one Rochester says, hey, boss, it's both informal and it has a twist of irony to it that if you want it to. But if you are thinking that this is a bad relationship, then you're upset that he's calling him boss because it reminds you of the old days. So again, I want you to think always there is this a frustration, conflicts in how we understand their relationship, that it could either make you happy or make you frustrated, depending on where you are when you listen to the show, what position you're in. So, as I said, after they make him smarter, they're nevertheless, the show, Jack, and the writers are determined to call out his color constantly, to call out that he is different from the rest of them. And they do that by, again, it's not film. You cannot see Rochester. But they create jokes and language to hear that is all about pointing out how black he is. I've got a couple examples. So this comes out in the dialogue. So once they are doing a skit of a Sutton's classroom, a children's classroom, and Jack is the teacher, and Rochester is a student in the class. And so Jack says, as the teacher, now Rochester. And Rochester goes, yes, boss. Jack says, can you name the seven wonders of the world? And Rochester goes, yes, sir. And he says, what are they? And Rochester says, the Sphinx, the pyramids, the Hanging Gardens, and four pork chops. Pork chops, schnitzels, you know, pork chops. And, you know, that's so. Jack says, now Rochester, pork chops are not included in the seven wonders of the world. And Rochester, I says, I guess you've never been to Harlem. So I want you to think it's funny, but again, it's playing on. It's playing on this kind of stereotype. So it's going back and forth, and really emphasizing that kind of thing. Well, another one. When Jack says to Rochester he wasn't going to make a film, Rochester said, I knew that you would do this thing. You have Rochester says back to Jack, you have as much willpower as me in a chicken coop, which means that he wants to grab and eat chickens. So again, these jokes play up these stereotypes like this. That will say Rochester has enormous appetites for pork chops, for chicken, for food, that he wants to drink to excess, that he loves to gamble, that he's all about, that he loves to take a knife and go fighting with knives. So the show works in every kind of bad stereotype about blacks, and it's kind of frustrating to listen to. Where is my... Now, but as I said, but it's interesting to listen to the shows because sometimes that kind of humor, the step and fetch it, stupid humor, will be undercut by Rochester getting his own back at Jack. This one, Jack will say, you know, it's a funny thing, but every time you press my pants, there's a hole in them. And Rochester goes, yeah, that's funny. As in, he's enjoying it, he's getting back at the man, but he's also stupid. Jack says, Don't laugh. Oh, well, I'll put on an old pair of pants so that I won't be late for breakfast. You know, Rochester, sometimes I don't know why I pay you. Rochester then says, I don't even know when you pay me. I love that he's getting back a little bit. Jack says, I told you I'd pay you as soon as I went back to work. Right now, I'm short of cash. Rochester says, what's that green stuff in your mattress? Is that grass in your mattress? Claiming that Jack is so cheap, and instead of going, that he hides his money in the mattress where he sleeps, hides the mattress. So Rochester says, if Jack says, I have no money, Rochester says, what's that green stuff in your mattress? Is it grass? And Jack says, oh, yes, it's just grass. Then Rochester said, well, I mowed a little of it yesterday. So I took some of it out, but making a joke saying he's mowing the grass, but meaning also that he'd stolen some of the money. But to him, he thinks it's justified because Jack will never pay him. So a part of the problem of the characterization is that Jack treats Rochester very poorly. Right? He never pays Rochester. He works Rochester like crazy. Rochester works 7 days a week, cooking and cleaning and doing the clothes and bathing Jack. And he just works all day long. And here's the problem, is that as real African Americans are trying to rise in society, they find it very frustrating that Rochester works so hard and gets no money for it. Why doesn't he just quit and leave? People say, why is he so loyal? Why does he stay with Jack? That if it were real life, he would just say, I quit and leave. But he never does. The show always says, oh, he's so loyal. So it's a very frustrating kind of thing. Okay, there's one about him stealing something. There's more stealing. They also play up literally, this I find this kind of interesting, literally they play up the black color of Rochester's skin. Again, because I think it's because it's radio and you can only hear and not see, they're determined to set up the difference between his blackness and everybody else's whiteness. So one time Jack and Mary and Rochester are going to visit a fortune teller. They're going to this mystery house. And they're going inside and it's very dark. Inside, it's all black, it's all dark inside. And Rochester says, this place is darker than a telephone booth in Harlem. That's a joke that would say in Harlem, everybody's black. Okay? So that if Harlem is everybody's black, then a telephone booth would be black. So this is a joke on a black color versus dark. Dark and black color. So Jack says, so if Rochester says, this place is darker than a telephone booth in Harlem, meaning full of blacks. Jack says, where are you? And Rochester says, here I am. And Jack says, open your eyes so that I can see you. Again, another very bad joke that conflates the darkness of the room and the blackness of Rochester's skin, that only the whites of his eyes would be visible. Again, this played with white audiences, but black audiences would go, oh, that's not a very good joke. That's, no. But they were a small part of the audience, and all the whites said, ah, ha, 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 that's funny. It's dark and it's black, okay? So another one. Oh, this is from the same skit I played for you yesterday. As they're getting ready to do the skit, and the men are all embarrassed that they're having to take parts as women. As I said, usually... as I said, most usually Rochester is kept away from the parts of the show where they know that they are putting on a radio show. But when they did that skit that I played yesterday about the film of the women playing that play, they needed more characters, and they had written in a part for Rochester. So they have Jack call Rochester and bring him into the studio so that he could be a part of this. So now Jack is telling Rochester he's going to have to play the part of a woman. And Rochester, being a masculine man, goes, no, I don't want to play a part of a woman, no. And so Jack says in that skit, he calls Rochester in, and Jack says, Rochester, I need you to play the part of my maid. I want you to be my female maid when I play Norma Shearer, when I play a woman. And Rochester goes, your maid, why can't I be your valet? Why can't I be your male servant? And Jack says, because I don't want a man in my room when I'm dressing. Jack actually enjoys, some people, he enjoys being a woman. Some, both are, as a cross-dresser, but perhaps as gay. So Jack, like, so he says, no, no, you must be a woman. So Rochester said, I ain't gonna wear no dress. And Jack says, you are too. And then Rochester says, I ain't gonna wear no mascara around his eyes. And Rochester, Jack says, yes, you are too. And Rochester says, it ain't gonna show. Which is a joke that says black mascara around his eyes will not show if he has a black face. Again, it's a bad joke, but it gets the radio audience to constantly remember that he has a black face. That black that mascara won't work because his face is already black. So they said these jokes over and over again are a combination of putting Rochester down, but sometimes, but always Rochester's very witty retorts end up putting Jack down and making him be smarter. But and so there's this constant going back and forth, and the two come together and clash in a skit in February 1939. They call it this comes together in a bad way in February 1939. One show. Jack is Jack has a rival, the guy he hates, another comic named Fred Allen, and the two comics hate each other and are jealous of her, and they're threatening to fight. So Jack wants to practice his boxing skills. So Jack and takes the crew, and they go out to a farm, and where Jack wants to have some boxing practice, and no one will box with him. So he says, Jack says, please, Rochester, slip on a pair of gloves. And box with me. And Rochester's going, no, no, I don't want to do it. Jack says, I insist, you must do it. So they put on the gloves, and they're boxing, they're playing. And because Jack is that kind of a guy, Jack will say, hey, Rochester, look over there. And Rochester looks over there, and Jack goes, pow, and knocks Rochester to the ground. And yet there's nothing Rochester can, right? So Rochester gets back up. And they're boxing, and they're playing, and they're playing, and they're boxing. And Rochester says, hey, Jack, look over there. Jack looks over there. Rochester goes, pow! And Jack hits the floor. Out fly his false teeth. Jack is very angry. Ah, I will fire you, Rochester. This is Jack is embarrassed. But Jack also gets angry. Rochester then is very afraid, and he's gone and hidden up in the attic. He runs and hides up in the attic because what he has done is can't happen in American culture. How dare a black man and a white man fight and a black man beat a white man? Talk about racism. Like, no, that can't happen. And yet it's just happened on the show for laughs and for fun. And you see that Rochester is very much justified in hitting Jack because Jack had pulled a mean trick on him. He's just getting Jack back. Nevertheless, there was a huge controversy after the show, and Jack remembered it in his autobiography. And Jack read, Jack wrote in his autobiography, there was the sound of an arm swishing through the air, the crack of a gloved fist meeting up with a glass jaw, meaning that Jack was going to fuck the thunk of a body hitting the floor. Boss, boss, Rochester cried. Get up, get up. I rose, and then Jack says, so did the American South. Raise an anger. Thousands of indignant persons below the Mason-Dixon line wrote in to complain that my permitting my African-American butler to punch me in the face was an attack on the white race and the dignity of the South. Until, he says, it was the this show brought the most mail, the most anger, the most complaint about the most fan mail of any show they've ever done up to that point. He says, Jack says, you've got to realize that most of my life I've been a political innocent. It never occurred to me that there was anything offensive in this humorous little episode. I was amazed at the at this revelation of people's strong feelings on the subject of race. To me, I was just doing a comedy show. Here I got to kind of fault Jack Benny. What world was he living in? On the one hand, I'm proud of him and this show for having them fight and for Rochester getting to take a whack at Jack Benny. I think that's useful. I think it's funny. I think it's something different. But Jack, because his show was sponsored by a commercial, you can't. He was terrified of anybody hating his show. If too many people wrote him bad things, his sponsor, Jell-O, might leave, might walk out, might fire him. So, in a way, Jack was very had to be very conservative and never want to make anyone angry. So, you see him go, oh, I didn't mean to offend anyone. And yet, on the other hand, when they would all they started traveling during World War II, they played shows at many military camps, and they traveled a lot. And when they would travel and they would go to cities, hotels in those cities would try to deny, not give Rochester a room. They would try to say, no, he cannot stay with us, stay with you. And Jack would always say, if he can't stay with us, we're all leaving and going to another hotel. So here's this mixture. Jack is, he's very loyal to Eddie Anderson, and he's very much about promoting civil rights when it comes to being equal and inclusive. And yet, there are all these times, and the way that the show is characterized, that he's opposite, the way that he's afraid of racist whites writing letters in. He's afraid of anyone being angry at him. They never had another episode. They never had another boxing match in 25, 30 years on the air. They never did that again. He was that frightened of it. How am I doing? Oh, I'm doing great. So, again, in this kind of me thinking about this evidence of is it racist? Is it awful? Is it liberal? Is it wonderful? Again, I found this very frustrating. In 1940, his sponsor Jell-O had a big parade and party. Hooray for Jack Benny! Let's celebrate Jack Benny. Mostly, Jack was threatening to leave for another sponsor. He wanted more money, and to convince Jack to stay, Jell-O threw a big party for him. And the publishing room, all these compliments paid. But the Jell-O put this ad in this program thanking Jack Benny. And it's very frustrating to me that this ad is no much better than this. So this is what, but so to come up to turn Rochester, who is really becoming this fascinating character, to reduce him back to step and fetch it in an ad like this. This is Rochester, boss. This is not English. This is very bad. It says, yes, sir, Mr. Benny. General Foods has sent over a great big cake with 10 candles and days a cod saying, congratulations, Jack, to you on your 10th year on the air. Oh. So I find this ad that's created by the Jell-O people plays down to every, and this was seen by people in the media industries and by Anderson himself. So this was not meant for the big public, but this was meant for other film industry people, radio industry people, other stars. And it depresses me. It makes me sad that the company would fall back on this stereotype, that they would assume that even people in the entertainment industry would want to think of Eddie Anderson and this character as this lower kind of person who can't speak well, who's stupid. So, as I said, I found this very frustrating. But at the same time that that happened, on the other hand, two amazing things happened. Really useful to do this. While I find this very abhorrent, on the other hand, very exciting things happen. The movie studios are having trouble. They always want new and better movies, and Jack works for Paramount Pictures, and the Paramount Studios wanted to make Jack a much bigger star. He had been making movies throughout the 30s, and if Jack's movies are really pretty dull, pretty boring. They never find a good script for him. His lines are not as good as on the radio show. His characters are dull and boring. Paramount, in 1939, makes this effort. They want to make Jack Benny a much bigger star. They hire this fabulous director, film director, Mark Sandrich, who had made the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers movies that I love, all those very good RKO movies. They hire that director to Paramount to work with Jack and make his movies better. So Mark Sandrich takes this script, finds a story, Man About Town, decides what might do, what might make Jack a bigger star, how about we work more of his radio show and his radio personality into the film? Now, the film industry and the radio industry were far apart. They hated each other. They were very jealous of each other because who's going to get the money? Who's going to get the audience? Who's going to get the box office? So mostly they're like this. Here is Paramount trying to work with radio in hopes that they can make money off this. So they said the interesting thing, so they start making this movie, but instead they start turning it into the radio show. And they bring in Phil Harris, Jack's band leader, and they give him a role. Well, Mark Sandrich also brings in Eddie Rochester Anderson. So they bring in, not that picture, they bring in Eddie into the film. And at first, Eddie's role is very small, but the director likes what he's doing so much that he gives Anderson another scene, and then a third scene, and then a fourth scene, and then a fifth scene. And by the time the film is finished, Anderson and Benny are interracial buddy movies. It's like a Will Smith and, you know, from... Huh? Yes. Or what's the one where they're chasing the bugs? The one set in New York? Men in Black. Okay, one. Or how about... Yeah, where's my brain today? So if you think of any of these movies that are so popular, were so popular from the 90s and 2000s, of a black star and a white star, men together and having adventures, and this becomes, yes, this becomes the very first one of those. Although you would not tell from the movie poster that Eddie Anderson is down here. In actuality, the two are all over there, and they're wonderful. They're very funny. They're very informal, and as I said, very equal. Even though Rochester plays a servant, he's a very smart servant. He's very knowledgeable. He's very funny. And as I said, the movie is virtually a buddy comedy like this. This film is hugely successful and total surprise. No one thought, everybody thought, oh, another Jack Benny movie. This will be terrible. When they see the movie, they go, wow, this is great. And interestingly, Paramount and together with Jell-O hold a gigantic premiere of this film in Jack's hometown of Waukegan, Illinois, near Chicago. So they have, instead of having a premiere in Hollywood, they hold it in Jack's hometown to play up all these associations. And it's a huge, I want you to think it's a huge, I found this on a for sale. I wasn't able to buy it, but I could take pictures of it. This is a scrapbook that somebody at the festivities took all these pictures. But it's wonderful. So they at the town, this was a little town of 50,000 people. 100,000 people journeyed to the town for this premiere. There were parades in the streets, there were parties, there were dances. There was a gigantic hoopla. And Eddie Anderson, this is him here, he was completely equal in this public activity. No Hollywood premiere, no public anything had ever been like this, to so prominently feature a black man together with white folks. No one had ever done anything like this. So 100,000 people in the premiere. They said all kinds of movie stars, special platforms. Eddie gets to speak. They put him in the parade. They give him honors. They give him the key to the city. So it's very exciting. And that film made a lot of money. And that made Paramount go one further. They said the next film will co-star as much as possible Jack, Benny, and Rochester. They called it Buck Benny Rides Again, which was an old skit on the radio show. And it's about them pretending to be cowboys out on a ranch in Nevada, and they're very bad, so it's very funny. But the idea of an African-American man in a bright yellow cowboy suit is kind of funny. But the whole film is the radio show. For this one movie, Jack Benny's character is called Jack Benny. Eddie Anderson's character is called Rochester. So it's literally taking the radio show and turning it into a movie. No one had ever done anything like that before. This movie was huge at the box office. It was like the number four movie of 1940 or 1941. So it's not a very good movie, but everybody enjoyed seeing it. Well, the exciting thing, so if they had this premiere in Jack Benny's hometown for Man About Town, what they did for Buck Benny again, I don't have any picture, I didn't bring any pictures of this. They actually had two separate premieres in New York City. They had a premiere at the Paramount Theater in downtown New York, but interestingly, they had a second full premiere in Harlem at the MGM Victoria Theater in Harlem to feature Eddie Anderson. And again, they had 100,000 people in the streets of Harlem there just to see Eddie. And he's riding along on a horse, and there's thousands of people clapping, and it's all in the newspapers, and it's on the radio, and it's just like, it's very exciting to read about, because it's like the first time, and about the only time, in a mainstream American prejudice culture that a black star is being so honored and so, made so very public. And I think in part it's because he's with Jack Benny. I think if he'd been only on his own, there would have been much more white backlash against it, much more like, oh no, we can't do that. But because it's with Benny, but it allowed an opportunity for mainstream white audiences to go, he's funny. He's great. He's like Will Smith. You know, he is like, I would say Richard Pryor. He is like, so very good. So, as I said, this was very exciting. Why I find that interesting is that the very same time, if you know about the film of Gone with the Wind, it premiered at the same time. It was a very controversial movie in the black community because all the black characters play roles of happy servants. Yes-um, yes-um, I will scrub, I love you. Okay, so black audiences are very angry about the film. White audiences love the romance and the South and Scarlet and Rhett and, you know. But as I said, the film is incredibly popular. They had, David, the producer, had its world premiere in the city of Atlanta, Georgia in December 1939, just in between when Jack Benny and Rochester had their two premieres. So right in the middle, they had a premiere in Atlanta. And Atlanta was so prejudiced that they would not allow Hattie McDaniel, could not come to, the other stars came to town, Clark Gable, Vivian Leigh, Olivia de Havilland, all these big stars journeyed to Atlanta where they had 100,000 people and parades in the streets and all this stuff, but they would not allow Hattie McDaniel, who played Mammy, she could not come with them. She could not be in the program. She could not have her picture along with the white folks. So I want you to think, that was the norm, that you cannot promote a black person. Oh no, that the racists will not allow it. This will be terrible. Ironically, that is Eddie Anderson. Eddie Anderson had a role in Gone with the Wind, but nobody ever talks about it. And he wore such makeup that I don't recognize him. He plays an old man. He plays the servant in Aunt Pity Pat's servant in Atlanta. It's a small role. He got some money for it, but he never talked about it. On the other hand, Hattie McDaniel, who plays Mammy, actually won an Academy Award. She won the Best Supporting Actress for 1940. It's the very first time an African American had won that award. And you know that when Halle Berry won the award, since then other actresses, black actresses, have won, and they always talk about how proud they are to be after Hattie McDaniel. So, but even winning an Academy Award, this actress was not allowed to go to Atlanta. The racists were so bad, they were so prejudiced, they were so determined to keep her down. But here, on the other hand, has been Eddie, got all this. So, it's a kind of, these film premieres and these movies made lots of money, and they made Eddie Anderson the biggest black star. How much time do I have left? Oh, good. Okay, I'm doing great. They made him, as I said, the biggest star, both on radio and in American film. You usually hear about people like Lena Horne and Dorothy Dandridge and actors like that. But nevertheless, at the box office, Eddie Anderson was tops. So, nope, I'm going the wrong way. There we go. This one. So, as I said, at the 1940-1941, just when America is entering World War, when we are finally entering the European War, he is considered the top black actor. It's very funny. Photographs of him. This is a Zoot suit. Anybody ever seen these before? Jazz musicians would wear them. And this is very, I love the story. The Zoot suit is a wild colors, yellow, blue, red, pink, purple. And they were a fashion for African-Americans and Hispanic-Americans. And it was to make them set themselves very much apart from the American soldier. If in the American military during the war, soldiers' uniforms were khaki or dull, they were green, they were gray, and they were very skinny. But here, the Zoot suit has pants that come out a yard. They have these big hats, they have these giant shoulders, they have these long coats. They have a watch chains. They said they're very cool cats, and you go strutting like this. It very much comes from musicians in jazz culture had developed wearing these costumes. But during World War II, even the costumes are something to fight over. Because for black Americans wearing these costumes, it was to say, you may hold me down in society, but look at me. Aha, here I am. I'm strutting. I'm beautiful. I'm wearing these outfits. To Americans in the military, this is a sign that you're not supporting the military. You're not in uniform. You're terrible. And so when soldiers on leave and having drunk too many beers would be on leave in the city, and when they would find somebody in a Zoot suit, they would beat up the person, they would strip the clothes off them, and they would pee on them. So to totally humiliate the wearer. So I want you to think the struggles of black culture to try and rise up and be counted for. Eddie was a part of that. Nobody ever beat Eddie Anderson up. So he was such a star that he could wear these things. But I want you to think white culture would look at him and go, oh, he looks like a clown. Oh, he looks ridiculous. To black culture, they would go, hey, he's styling. He's looking all right. So I want you to think of the differences. Well, nevertheless, he's a big star. And during World War II in the 1940s, he actually stars in several films. MGM and Fox made several entirely black cast musicals, made Stormy Weather. He is in Cabin in the Cotton. They're medium quality films. On the one hand, it was very exciting to see the entire cast be black actors. And this was meant for a white audience, as well as black audiences. So it was a way to say, look, they're talented, they're beautiful, accept them, this is all right. But a very careful effort not to mix black and white at all. So no Jack Benny and these things. But so Rochester is a big star. I like this, comes from the advertising trailer for the film. This is the man Jack Benny discovered, or did Rochester make Jack Benny famous? Because indeed, Eddie Anderson's role on the radio and in these films is making Jack Benny the top number four star in American movies. And it's all due to co-starring with Eddie Anderson. So, and they are together, black and white. So I want you to think it was a time of hope. And indeed, one of the African-American newspapers wrote an article, published an article as an editorial, and they called it, Rochester represented the new day. And they say Rochester represents change in the social order, that look at the things he's achieving, mean in the future we'll have more black stars and more understanding and more acceptance by white culture and more, it's all wonderful. So, as I said, he Eddie Anderson represents the high point of, yes, it's going to be fine. Yes, it's going to be great. Yes, it's going to be wonderful. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Pretty soon, but nevertheless, so yes, it's going to be wonderful. Rochester, this is the one time that a black performer was in one of those fan magazines that I've been talking about. This is a radio fan magazine. And they actually did a story about Eddie Anderson. But the story itself plays to the worst prejudices. They talk about what kind of pork chops he eats, how much he likes food, how much he likes to drink. So on the one hand, they're including him in fan magazines. On the other hand, they're stereotyping him in a bad way. On the other hand, for good, Eddie Anderson got a role in another Hollywood movie. Now, this is a white movie called Brewster's Millions. It's been made a dozen times. It's the story of a young man who can inherit some money, but the catch of inheriting the money is he must spend all this money by a certain date. And if he can spend all the money, then he will get in his inheritance. So, as I said, it's just a boring movie. Rochester Eddie Anderson is hired for about the fourth role in the film, the fourth one down. And he actually plays a servant. But he exhibits in this film the same kind of, I mean, just plain camaraderie of, he's not kept separate. He knows he's the employee, but they treat the white actors on this in this movie treat him with respect and friendship. He is more like an employee who's a friend rather than a servant scrubbing the floor. Well, when this movie comes out in 1945, and there's an uproar in the American white South, the film censor in Memphis, Tennessee, bans it. He says, you cannot show this film. He says, because that man is shown too much equality, you can't have it. No, we will not show the film. And cities all over the South did the same thing. I want you to think that there was a big backlash after this idea of new hope and excitement. Conservative, racist whites, very conservatives, are going, no, we do not want change in society. We've got to stop it now. And so they do things. Like, as they said, they're trying, they see change, they try to stomp it out. So they banned this film. Now they didn't ban Jack Benny's radio show. They couldn't stop it from coming over the air. And I think that's in part because he's very much Benny's boy, that he's under the protectorship of Jack Benny. But when he's separate in a film, the white South would go, no, we're going to ban it, going to stop it altogether. That ended Eddie's career in films, very sadly. He was getting older. He was near 50, so he's not this hot young man. You know, he's no Brad Pitt. He's no Leo DiCaprio. He's getting older. But nevertheless, the Hollywood producers' fears, oh, they're so chicken, they're so afraid of the white South that they might not get money at the box office. This would be terrible. It basically ends Eddie's career. Nevertheless, while his film career, and he had done quite well, Hollywood is very lazy. Hollywood is very chicken. Hollywood is very, what I want to say, they kowtow to racist white beliefs. Nevertheless, Eddie maintained the number one character on Jack Benny's popular show all the way until 1965. So this is still from 1945, 20 more years to 1965, he remained Jack Benny's closest character. So he remained the highest paid black, but the problem was he also started catching grief from the young black community. Those soldiers coming back, black soldiers coming back from World War II want freedom and equality now, got very frustrated that he's always the servant, that he says, yes, boss. Well, he doesn't cheat and steal and lie or drink too much anymore. They said they don't like the idea that he's a servant. And then they're very frustrated that he can't just be his Jack Benny's friend, that he must be Jack Benny's servant. And while they think that Eddie Anderson is a very good performer, they said they're very frustrated with the relationship. And so the black community comes down on Rochester and down on Eddie Anderson, and they criticize him. They call him an Uncle Tom. No, you're terrible. And that was very hurtful to Eddie Anderson because he says it was the role out there. You know, that's can't you see? There have been all through a theater history, there have been masters and servants. There is Harlequin and his master. There have been from the Greeks, there were servants, slaves and masters. In 20th century literature, there was Jeeves, the butler, and Bertie Wooster. This is British comedy. And Jeeves, the butler, was much, much smarter. And he got Bertie, the stupid young man, stupid rich young man, out of many scrapes. And Rochester says, can't you understand that? It's just that kind of a relationship. But here's the problem in American culture, that with black and white, it can never be that simple. And it was very frustrating. The black community, the liberal black community, so wanted true equality, you know, total equality. And it very much frustrated him that Eddie had to play a servant role. Nevertheless, as the show goes on for years and remains in American culture, and I'm going to show you two very brief clips, the show becomes more like that they are best friends. That, that here they could celebrate the new year together. He said even in things like out in popular culture, Jack and Roger and Eddie Anderson were always associated with each other. I'm going to try and play two very brief clips. See if I can do this. I can do this. One. All right. Wait. Okay, so this is a very brief one, and I need to get my sound up. Can we? Okay, in this little scene, because after they were on radio for many years, Jack moves to television, and Eddie Anderson becomes his number one partner on this. In this very brief clip, Eddie Rochester has gone to a store to buy a Christmas present, to buy a holiday gift for Jack, his boss. And the clerk is going to say, ask, please, and how can I help you? What should you get? Rochester doesn't know what to buy Jack. And so the clerk asks him, tell me about your boss. What kind of a man is he? And I will help you find the right thing. So here you will see Eddie making fun of, with it's affectionate fun of, but here you can see he's not beholden to the boss, that he very much likes to put him down. So that's what we're going to try and do.
What kind of man is your boss? Is he the athletic type?
No.
Is he the intellectual type?
Well, no.
The executive type?
No.
Well, perhaps the outdoor type?
No.
Well, perhaps he's the playboy type?
No.
So you can see that he loves to make jokes. They're affectionate, but they're jokes. I've got one more clip that shows. Here's Jack as his worst, penny pinching and vain and stupid. And you will see Rochester, who's driving the car, and it's an ancient car. You're supposed to understand that this car is 50 years old when everyone else has new cars. And Jack is a very wealthy man, but his determination to be cheap and not spend money is the joke here, as well as always finding people who want to frustrate him and make fun of him. Watch Rochester as the servant both sort of go along with him, but also through his smiles and waves and winks, understand that he too is making fun of Jack. So this is just a 4-minute one, and we'll... The man is looking incredible. Such an old car.
How many, please?
Well, I don't know.
Well, we've still got 73 miles to go.
Jack doesn't even want to
buy gas. Yeah, that's if we stick on the main highway. Say, mister, is this the only way to get to Palm Springs?
Oh, no. There are several ways. I would suggest that from here, you head straight for Saturn. Turn right to Mars, make a left to Jupiter, then head for the moon, and then...
Wait a minute. Mars, Jupiter, the moon?
Yeah. Ain't this a rocket ship?
Just put in some gas, will you? Ethel or regular?
Ethel.
Ethel would be the more expensive.
Look, Rochester, the last time we came through here, we went pretty fast. What do we use then?
Nothing. We'd lock bumpers with a Greyhound bus.
Wait a minute. What are you doing? I'm sorry. I thought you had a windshield.
Here, let me wipe the bugs off your glasses.
Look, never mind. Well, have you made up your mind whether you want regular or Ethel?
Regular.
Okay. The water and oil's fine.
All right, as long as the hood is up, check my battery.
Okay.
So instead of a car battery...
Looks okay to me.
How many? I'll tell you when to stop. Let me know how many you're putting in.
Okay.
One.
He counts the gallons.
Two. Three.
Now Jack is happy. Maybe it's full. Maybe he doesn't need more. He's very happy. Maybe it's full.
Damn. What happened to the bell?
What do you want? Gas or music?
That's why I owe you. Let's see. 10 gallons. That'll be $2.80.
$2.80. Here. Well. There.
Thank you. And the next time you pass this gas station, please do.
All right, why did I? Well, Rochester, start the car.
Yes, sir.
Keep your voice down. My wife is in the office.
He's playing with a dirty story.
Come on, Roger.
Yes.
Now, here comes a nice car.
Say, boy, which way to Palm Springs?
The Palm Springs? Well, you... Oh, just follow us.
So, thanks for watching those. I said, hopefully you could see from that, I said that even though Eddie Anderson always had to play a servant with Rochester, the show and was really wonderful about always finding ways of making them seem much more equal. And I think that in that way that Eddie Anderson's career served as a really useful example in American culture of still of hoping for the hope of improvement and of African Americans' role in American society, the hope for equality. But as I said, it could be read in a number of ways. It could for racist whites, they could be very glad that he was a servant. If you were sort of liberal, as I said, you could still say, "Oh yes, all blacks must remain servants." If you're smart, you see that they really Rochester really has Jack Benny's number, that Rochester's superior in many ways, that he runs Jack Benny. For the most of the black community, they could be so very proud of when there are so very few black people. Here was a star who was beloved by all. But for the most liberal black critics, they were nevertheless were very dissatisfied. They said, we really want stars of our own. We really want independent. Where are our cowboys? Where are our doctors and lawyers? Where are our superheroes? Why must the only few characters that are of blacks in American major media be servants always? Why always lower in American society? And as I said, Anderson had to negotiate this all his life. He found it very frustrating, and the way he adapted was by being sort of a very private man, but not giving, on the one hand, enjoying his paycheck, but on the other hand, feeling that he had to be very quiet and he couldn't go out and talk about himself, that he had to remain very private. I appreciate very much that we've gotten through the whole series of 6 lectures. I want to thank you very much for your patience and listening to me. I welcome, please send me questions. Let me know. Come visit me in Austin. And we're in Texas. It's a big state. We'd love to have you. I wish you great success. And thank you very much for the privilege of talking to you this week. Thank you. So thank you.